Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. I just had the great pleasure of talking with Marwa El-Shakri about her new book, Reading Darwin in Arabic, 1860 to 1950. This came out with the University of Chicago Press in 2013. Now, it's always a great pleasure for me and really a special pleasure when I have the chance to talk with an author about a book that I not only really loved, but also feel is really important. And this is one of those books. This is an absolute must read if you are interested in Darwin studies, histories of evolution, history of translation and science and translation in particular, histories of the modern Middle East, social thought, ideas of civilization, etc., etc. It's a really important book and very widely relevant to a number of fields that El-Shakri is speaking to and is writing from. The book takes us into what seems like a very specific context, right? The translation of the works of Darwin, and it uses it to open up a much larger story about the ways that authors reading and writing in Arabic language discourse in the late 19th and early 20th centuries are using reading and engagement with the works of Darwin and others he's associated with in order to reconceptualize and to argue and debate about concepts including society, civilization, what's happening in the larger political context of British occupation, of the French capture of Tunis, of what's happening in Turkey, etc., etc. And so it's the book is doing a kind of work that situates a very specific local case study within a much larger context. It's just a really fascinating story. You'll learn about authors who you may not have known about before and ways of thinking about the relationships in particular between what we might consider to be separate categories, science and religion, although the book problematizes those really usefully. And it's just a really interesting, fascinating read. So I will stop there and let you get to it. It was really a pleasure to talk with Marwa about it. It was a pleasure to read the book, and I really do hope you have a chance to read it after you listen to the interview, because it's well worth the time. We're here today to talk with Marwa El-Shakri about her new book, Reading Darwin in Arabic, 1860 to 1950. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Marwa, and thank you very, very much for making time to talk with me today.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure, and I should say right at the outset that I really loved the book, and I also think this is a really important book, not just a really well-written and exhaustively researched book. So I'm really delighted that we have a chance to talk about it today and to also translate it a little bit for our audience, speaking of translation, which is something that I'm sure we'll be talking about a little bit later.
Thanks. I look forward to chatting about it too.
So Marwa, can you start us off, as is traditional for the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society channel, by saying just a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, how did you come to academic work in the history of science?
Right. So I actually majored in biology as an undergraduate and kind of fell into the history of science accidentally, in fact, or felt like it at the time, as many things do. And I think I actually went into academia sort of not really thinking I was going to stay on for very long, and just was one of these things, history of science from the point of view of a biologist. At the age of 21 or whatever I was, it seemed like this kind of strange sister creature. So I went into it with that attitude, really, just kind of with a sense of curiosity. And I think I sort of ended up choosing the topic and subject of this book in kind of the same way. Just kind of picking up interests as I kind of move forward with my work and with my thoughts. And evolution, I guess, had been something that as a biologist I had focused on quite a lot. And so it seemed kind of natural to kind of fuse together some of my interests at that point.
It's really interesting because it sounds like we both came to the history of science in really similar ways, just background in the sciences and working in the life sciences and deciding to kind of look at that as a historical phenomenon. Yeah. So the book that we're talking about today looks at the reception and translation of, and also the engagement with, the ideas of Darwin and associated thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Arabic language contexts. And those different contexts and those kind of differences between those different contexts come out really nicely in the book, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about those in the context of our discussion. Now, you've talked a little bit about how you came to the topic, kind of stumbling upon it, and again, the context of having a background in the life sciences and focusing on that as part of your historical project as well. Now, this started out as a dissertation project, if I'm correct, and it's transformed in the course of dissertation to book into the monograph that we have now. So if you wouldn't mind, can you talk a little bit about that transformation? Were there any major ways that the project changed from dissertation to book, or the ways in which the way you were thinking about the arguments of the book or the nature of the book as an object changed from one form to another?
Yeah. You know, I think this is something that we've spoken about this before, but you know, it's something that we think about a lot, and I think writers think about it one way or another a lot in the process of editing a work. And I think that transition from dissertation to first book, you know, is a kind of interesting one in many ways. And I, you know, I spent quite a bit of time actually in that transition phase. And you know, I think in a way it was a good thing to do, and I think it helped me to expand the project in a number of ways that I wouldn't have done otherwise. But in other ways, it was kind of frustrating because it kind of brought to mind this sense that, you know, as a writer, you're always sort of chasing a moving target, and you're always kind of recreating yourself as a writer in some ways too. So it was kind of, the editorial process was probably more painful than it should have been otherwise. But as I said, I think I got a lot out of it. Probably it's given me something to think about when also speaking to students and other people who worry about publishing and worry about the length of time that one needs to spend on editing. So I tend to kind of give both versions of that story one way or another.
So were there any kind of conceptual foci of the book that weren't in the dissertation, or any ways that the argument itself underwent any kind of metamorphosis from one form to the other?
I think the basic structure of the book, it's interesting, the first few chapters in any case kind of stayed the same. And that was in some ways kind of frustrating because I somehow the analytical framework in my mind had shifted over time, and I'd brought in, for instance, translation and translation theory had become more and more important over time. But also certain things shifted in terms of my understanding, for instance, of the connection between, say, natural theology and the different versions of natural theology, which I had in mind to some extent, but became sharper over time. I could sort of rewrite bits of it, but sort of kind of writing the book all over again, which at some point one doesn't really want to do, although some people do, and I admire that, but I never got to that point. So in a way, the first few chapters are kind of similar, but it was more of this issue of kind of adding different layers of analysis over time.
Mm-hmm. So you've brought up the importance of translation and translation theory, and this is actually a really nice place to segue into the book itself. In the introduction, you talk about the importance of and the challenges of reading in and writing about translation and translation of texts, of ideas, of practices, is really one of the major themes that threads through many of the chapters. Have there been any particular areas of translation theory, translation practice, that have been especially important in informing how you think about translation in the context of the work that the book is doing?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting how translation kind of occurred to me in the issue of translation as a kind of analytical or let's say, theoretical question that occurred to me in the course of writing this. It was actually not so much through reading the literature and through reading translation theory, but actually in trying to translate text myself and thinking through the problem of translation. And I was also doing it as a kind of second or third order translator, right? So I was reading a text in Arabic that had been written originally in English, but oftentimes it wasn't written originally in English. It was translated from the German or from the French. And sometimes, you know, there was another link in that chain. And so I would read these different versions. And I would, as a reader, I would think, my God, these are completely different texts. Like, you know, what's going on? How am I going to somehow in the process of translating or thinking through this process of translation make sense of the different layers of meaning? And it kind of questioned my own reading also of the original text in some ways at different points too. So I kind of went to different bits of translation theory, and there are lots of, you know, readers out there and compendiums, and it's a really fascinating field in literary theory and literary criticism that I think we can learn a lot from as historians of science. And it just provided a kind of language suddenly for something that I kind of experienced and struggled with. And that process in particular of searching for equivalences, right? So the problem of equivalency at a theoretical level, and the fact that they are never ever two perfect equivalents across language, and sometimes even within a language, words or signs have different layers of meaning. So it just really got me thinking about, you know, the stuff that I was reading and how I was reading it as well.
This is also a really, we didn't plan this ahead of time, but you've anticipated my next comment, actually, which is the title. Even though so much of the book is about translation, the title of the book is not Translating Darwin. The title of the book is Reading Darwin.
Right.
And a lot of the book is about sort of rethinking, at least on an implicit level, right? Rethinking what reading means, what reading is, and really holding reading up as a conceptually interesting process that involves interpretation, as you put it early in the book, appropriation, omission, etc. Well, obviously it was a conscious decision, but was the decision to call this Reading Darwin, given your early comments in this introduction of the book about reading as a process, did that come from some way that you wanted readers to rethink what reading is, or more largely did some conceptual way of thinking about reading and the kind of work that it does inform how you approached the book?
Yeah. I mean, I think the title, as all titles do, I'm sure, had a kind of interesting genesis, which I probably won't remember entirely now. But, you know, partly it was the fact that to use translation and translating, I think that was the general consensus anyway from people that I was speaking to, you know, the publishers in particular, the editors that I was working with, who thought it sounded a bit technical, and I can see that. And so there was something about trying to capture the process of what I was getting at, which wasn't entirely about translation consistently in each chapter as well, that I thought fitted this process of reading. And it was, as I said, you know, it came out of the experience of reading texts in translation. But it also, I think, connects up to, you know, reading Darwin in Arabic specifically, which is to say, you know, I would find myself trying to describe my Arabic readers to people who worked on, let's say, Darwin studies or evolutionary studies writ more broadly, but usually centered somewhere in Europe, if not Victorian England, and try and sort of somehow explain the way in which they read this text. And often it seemed to me there was always some issue of whether or not they were reading it correctly or incorrectly. And so I had to really confront that issue very early on. And so I think, in a way, for me, in any case, what I wanted to get at with that title, apart from the various plays that it sort of incorporates was this process of thinking about the nature of reading as a as perhaps a more kind of complicated process than we've maybe thought of before.
Thank you. So Darwin's work was perhaps one of the most widely read kinds of work globally in the context that you're looking at in the 19th century, late 19th century especially. And you talk early on in the book about the aspects of Darwin's work that perhaps lent it to having a tremendously global appeal. It was translated not just into and out of Arabic, but in Chinese and many, many other languages and contexts. You call it brilliantly ambiguous. It's work that could be assimilated into lots of different local traditions of thought in lots of different ways. And he was kind of usefully indefinite and at times inconsistent about the question of religion in his writings. And this way of negotiating between what we might consider to be more religious aspects of the writing and scientific aspects of the writing is something that's very much a kind of motor over the course of the book and as we look at and try to understand the way it was taken up in Arabic language discourse. In this context, in the late 19th century, just to kind of set the stage for listeners who may not be aware of the kind of the importance of the late 19th century to the history of science more broadly, you very helpfully explain here that in the late 19th century, science became at once Western, modern, and universal. And thanks to this transformation in how science was understood, the notion of civilization was transformed as a result. And this also winds up playing a really important role later in the book. Now, in order to take us into the specific case studies that you're looking at, the first chapter opens by looking closely at a popular science monthly called, in English, The Digest, in Arabic, Al-Muqtataf. So can you maybe start us off by introducing Al-Muqtataf? What kind of journal was this? What kinds of things was it publishing? And can you situate it within the wider ecology of popular science writing in 19th century Syria and Egypt?
Okay, great. Sure, yeah. I mean, this was, I think, probably the single most important journal in a way for the book, but also for Arabic popular science writing of the time. So I think it's interesting to think about both how it's founded and then also to think through its popularity really over many years. And it's founded in the 1870s and lasts really until 1952. So ends with sort of kind of revolutionary Egypt in the 50s, which is also interesting. So essentially it's founded by two native tutors, as they were called, instructors by the names of Yaqub Serouf and Feres Nimr. And there was a third member of the group who was the printer, Shaheen Makarias, who's also kind of a native assistant for Syrian Protestant College, which was where they were teaching at the time or working at the time. And they had also been students at this college and had worked closely with some of the original American Protestant missionaries who had gone to Beirut, to proselytize, but which actually ended up meaning teaching sort of the basics, kind of reading, writing, and arithmetic and that sort of thing. And it was really about the promotion of literacy and a certain model of universal education. And underneath it, in a sense, it was a kind of civilizing mission. And this tension between civilizing and proselytizing was something that missionaries were actually very aware of, and they thought about it constantly. And the fight, as it were, or the struggle usually took place differently depending on where you were situated. So if you were sort of in the field or abroad, then you usually tended to take a slightly different view from, say, trustee members and board members at home. In any case, this idea had started, according to records that we have, in any case, from what people have said in diaries and whatnot, started through a Protestant missionary by the name of Cornelius van Dyck, who had been one of these early founders of the Beirut mission station. Well, not founders, but a very important early member of that station. And two of the two tutors, as I mentioned, and the printer. And the idea was really to kind of popularize all of this science writing that they were translating and teaching to their students in Arabic, but they wanted somehow to reach broader audiences. And so they basically started off by translating a kind of rough summary translations, we would call it. They sort of have these little sort of digests of Victorian and American popular science journals. So they were, in a sense, kind of really part of that sort of late 19th century trend in which you had this huge rise popular journals of a wide variety of kinds, literary and scientific. And in fact, they saw themselves as literary and scientific. And over time, the literary would become more important, I think.
Now, you've mentioned the Syrian Protestant College, and you talk early in this part of the book about the importance of the college in translating science into Arabic in this period. Now, there's a strong interest in science education at the college that was part of the larger missionary project. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of Protestants to this context? There's quite a bit of controversy over the translation of Darwin in Arabic in this context, but work on Darwin in Arabic was actually strongly supported by Protestants, and it has to do in part with the kind of work being done at this college. So why were Protestants so supportive of this translation of Darwin into Arabic? And can you maybe talk about that in the context of the way we understand science and religion? And I know I'm using an unfair dichotomy here, right? I mean, one of the kinds of work that the book does is precisely to break down this dichotomy between science and religion. But in any case, can you talk about Protestants in this context and their relationships or the ways that they were using science and religion together to forward their own goals in the context of Syria?
Absolutely, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, apart from the connection, as I mentioned, with universal education, say that in a sense, one has to understand Darwin, and perhaps this might be a shared kind of, if we want to call it a global story, you could say that, but this may be a kind of shared story depending on how important missionaries were for various, you know, sort of autochthonous translations that they helped to produce, which I think they played a role in a number of translations across the world like that. So, I mean, that's one aspect, is that it's bound up with kind of pedagogy and with their view of education, which is of course, ultimately a kind of spiritual project. But I think there's another way that it's very important for this story, and it's connected to the editors of Al Muqtataf, and it's connected to a number of other figures in the book, and it is also connected institutionally to the fact that they're coming out of the Syrian Protestant College, which is a kind of interdenominational a school that's set up by a number of donors from the US and England and elsewhere. But I think that you know, if you follow the kind of curriculum and if you follow the reading list that a lot of these people are sort of engaging with at this time, out of that school and out of that context, you start to see how the science and religion how this kind of question of science and religion come together in different ways. And I think primarily what it is that they are, in fact, reading a lot of literature that is coming out of particular schools, different sort of theological schools that are coming out of the U.S. in particular. And these are Protestant theologians, usually American theologians, who are mixing together some variety of kind of Spencerian thought with a kind of Darwinian evolutionary thought, and trying to at the same time make that compatible with Protestantism writ large. So the way in which actually a lot of people read this in Arabic is not so much as a kind of incompatibility, which is why that controversy over Darwin in the 1880s that I talk about in the book strikes the editors and many other students at that school as very odd, because they were kind of imbibing this much more kind of syncretic, let's call it, sort of Spencerian view of evolution, which had strong sort of overtones of kind of natural theology and whatnot, and didn't necessarily see that as kind of incompatible with religious faith, and couldn't understand the argument, in fact, entirely, or so they claimed at the time. It may have been a rhetorical argument, but I think in some ways they were surprised by the extent of the reaction. So I think that's also interesting, because in a way, you know, you start to appreciate, you know, sort of viewing their understanding of evolution and seeing how it changes over time, depending on what they're reading and the kinds of conversations they're engaging with. So you can see, for instance, once they start speaking with Muslim theologians, how their understanding also shifts. Well, once they start reading classical medieval works on, alchemy and transformationism and so forth, or emanationism, their ideas also start to shift, and you can kind of hear echoes of that in their writings at different points. So I think the presumption that somehow, you know, science and religion are these two kind of antithetical, totally separate creatures sometimes blind us to the ways in which actually we approach each through the other.
Great. And you mentioned the work of Spencer a couple of times just now. As we move from chapter one to chapter two, just to kind of mark for listeners without going into too much detail, we also move with these two tutors, Saruf and Nimr. We move from the Syrian Protestant college to Egypt. They move here. They are interested, as they move to Egypt, in helping promote the idea of a Nahda, an Arab awakening. And they turn here, and you take us through this turn to the work of Herbert Spencer to kind of understand science and its relationship to society, to social progress, to his idea of a social organism. And in this chapter, you also talk quite a bit about the importance of print culture and the printing press to helping them and others work through the ideas of Spencer, especially in the context of what's called the Eastern Question and kind of the way to understand race and civilization in the context of Arabic-speaking societies in this context. Now, as we move from there to the next chapters, we move into a particular debate over materialism in the context of late 19th century Arabic discourse. Now, in chapter three, you take us into the works by a couple of major translators, writers, thinkers here, Shibli Shumayil and Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani. Mm-hmm. And take us into different ways of thinking about materialism and materialisms in the context of engagement with not just the work of Darwin, but also the work of and the translation of some commentaries on Darwin's work from the early 1880s. For example, Ludwig Büchner's commentaries on Darwin. So mm-hmm. Let's look briefly at this. Can you tell us a little bit about Shibli Shumayil? Who is he? How is he understanding materialism in the context that he's working on? And what elements of that are debatable and are controversial in the context of the larger work that the chapter's doing?
Okay. Shumayil is kind of, he plays an interesting role, I think, in the book, and I think in the Arabic press scene in general. I think he's conscious of that. So, you know, he likes his kind of renegade status. And so I think in some ways, he's kind of a deliberate sort of provocateur, right? He's kind of using his materialism in a way to question the sort of unthinking spiritualisms, as he puts it, you know, a little haya of his audiences or some of his audiences. So, you know, I think, again, perhaps maybe we need to understand you know, kind of what he's saying in the broader context of how people are understanding also a certain distinction between, say, spirit and matter, science and religion, and he's trying to shake that up a little bit. But having said that, I think he starts off kind of promoting spontaneous generation and really sort of taking the view, despite the fact that much of the sort of scientific evidence or consensus really had moved against that, that it had been kind of proven and therefore evolution was in a fact, right, that could have real material evidence. So there was always that question in some people's minds of the sort of point of origin, right, which is to say that it wasn't just about the problem of finding transitionary forms, but also of thinking of how you can keep going back through that chain to that first, right, sort of generation. And so the generation of life from dead matter, as he was often putting it in various slogans, was something that he thought really was necessary to kind of make a kind of convincing logical explanation for evolution seem justifiable for most people. So I think that was really what motivated him. But I think in other ways, you know, he was much more of a kind of a vitalist and idealist, and sort of he borrowed from German materialism, but there are sort of strong echoes, I think, of German idealism in his thought, and that he didn't necessarily develop very well. I mean, he was primarily a doctor, and you know, sort of wrote on these subjects on the side, and enjoyed, as I said, having this kind of.
Marwa, sorry, I think we got cut off. We were talking in the last part of our conversation about materialism in the context of Shibli Shmuel and who was a defender of these ideas. But as we move into the last part of this chapter and into the next chapter, you introduce us to some people who are actually arguing against kinds of materialist ideas that Shmuel was defending in favor, or rather was arguing in favor of. These include Afghani, as I mentioned earlier on, but they also include a Sufi sheikh, Hussein al-Jisr. And this is somebody who is the focus of chapter 4. So can you talk a little bit about Jisr's work? In what way was he trying to challenge materialist arguments? And what's important for us to understand about his work and his ideas in order for us to understand what's happening in this part of the book in terms of what you're arguing here?
Right. I think essentially, you know, much of the rest of the book, one could think of this way, although I don't know if I necessarily presented that way, and maybe not chapter 5 explicitly, but many of the other figures in the rest of the book are essentially kind of conversing with Shmuel's hypothesis that evolution necessarily has to have a kind of, you know, must be understood within a materialist framework. And so just as the first person, I think, to really challenge that extensively, certainly the first person to challenge it from the perspective of, you know, a Muslim theological framework. And so essentially what he does in this book is he kind of embeds it in a series of arguments in which basically, you know, the book is organized around various sects or schools that emerged from the time of the Prophet Muhammad to the present, although the chronology and the sense of temporality isn't necessarily consistent. So, you know, past and present critics kind of meld into one. But it's organized kind of thematically against, you know, sort of around this question of disbelief and what were the conditions or the, what were the sort of factors that led people to refute this message of Islam. And so one of the chapters is on evolutionary materialism, and he's very careful to kind of put the two together and then also to separate them at different points in the course of that chapter. And so that chapter where he deals with evolutionary materialism is kind of organized as a series of, you know, it's like a kind of Socratic dialogue, and so it's a sort of series of questions and answers that a Sufi sheikh is being asked by a young student evolutionary materialist. And I think it's also kind of a metonym for what a lot of people worried at that time, which was that you were getting these young students, as they thought of it, going into these new schools, learning about the new sciences and understanding in a kind of materialist way. And so this was meant to be a kind of corrective. And so basically, to make a long story short, he refutes the idea that a materialist perspective is necessary for an evolutionary one, and shows that most of the laws of evolution that Darwin is describing, or that this evolutionary materialist is describing, are commonsensical, and that there's nothing really new to it, but that it would be incorrect on a logical or syllogistic ground to argue for a materialist view of the evolution of life.
Great. Now, you brought up education as one of the issues that he's concerned with, and the end of this chapter and along with the next chapter look carefully at the issue of education, and in particular debates about the place of science education in school curricula and sort of arguments for reform of school curricula in light of the ideas, this kind of evolutionary ideas, the kinds of ideas that are being engaged with, translated into, and discussed in the context of Arabic language literature on these topics. Now, one of the people who's also interested in this is the Mufti in Chapter 5, Darwin and the Mufti. This is the Grand Mufti of Egypt, Muhammad Abdu. Can you talk a little bit about him in this context? Because he is, along with Adjisr, who we just talked about in the previous chapter, this Mufti is interested in bringing together ideas of evolution with Quranic exegesis, right? And so he's another person who doesn't necessarily think that Quranic ideas and contemporary ideas of evolution are incompatible. It's just it's a matter of how you interpret evolutionary ideas and how you bring them to bear on an idea of rationality in Quranic exegesis. So this is a long way of asking you to talk a little bit about Muhammad Abdu. How is he important to the story as you're telling it in this part of the book? And what's important for us to understand about the contributions he's making to these debates?
Right. So Abdu is a kind of important and much cited figure for people who work on almost any aspect of let's call it sort of Muslim intellectual history in the 20th century. And partly because I think he quickly gains this reputation shortly after his death in 1905 of being kind of, you know, Muslim modernist. And this is a term that comes from, as I think I try and explain in the book briefly, from Catholic modernism. And so this idea that by wedding together sort of science and theology, one would create a new modernist kind of theological strain was really, I think, what captured people's imagination who were writing about Abdu after his death in particular, and helped to kind of promote his reputation, I think, in different ways. But he's also, I think, an interesting figure because he didn't, as you mentioned, they didn't really see this question of evolution and exegesis as a particularly problematic one, and that he thought in particular that there were many, hermeneutical and exegetical trends in Muslim theology that allowed for a certain kind of flexibility. And so some of the issues that he thought confronted Christian theologians seemed really just not to be an issue at all for him. And he's explicit about that in some ways. And also, I think, because he was a rationalist and a sort of self-consciously promoted Islam as a kind of rationalist theology and creed. He I think also wanted to make that argument for compatibility on those grounds. But I think the question of education really was what drew him into this whole debate. And in a way, I you know, he doesn't actually say much about Darwin and about evolution, and I say that in the chapter. But he's a really important figure, and I think the fact that he gets bound up with debates about evolution, as he does at the end of his life, in terms of, you know, sort of the fact that some people start to use his interest in evolution or his reference to Darwin and Spencer against him, and the fact that he's also thinking about science education more broadly, gets really at the heart of what I think this book is about. And so in some ways, it's a bit like the relationship between evolution and education that kind of motivated the X Club and other people who tried to rethink the nature of the role of the state vis-a-vis its citizens and the nature of the education they got. And so there was something about the way in which a lot of evolutionists, and it was Spencer in particular that he admired, approached this question that really captured his imagination and actually fit with his, I think, pedagogic program in interesting ways.
Great. And just for listeners who are particularly interested in the history of education, I'll just signal that there's a really interesting and very extended discussion in this chapter, the end of chapter 5, about sort of his ideas for the reform of Al-Azhar. And you talk about the fact later on in this chapter that even though those reforms didn't really happen, as a consequence, we have the first modern university in Egypt founded. And so it's a really interesting chapter in the history of pedagogy and education, as well as these larger issues that we have been talking about. Now, you mentioned the state, which again really nicely brings us into the next chapter on evolutionary socialism. Now, as you take us into this chapter, we learn about forms of utopian discourse in Arabic. Now, they become more and more associated with science and technology in discussions of how to achieve the perfect state in the future. And this comes along with what you characterize as a new Darwin for Arabic readers. And this is a Darwin and a kind of Darwinian thought that's more focused on mutual aid and the power of social cooperation. So we move here from the individual to the collective. So can you talk a little bit about that? Sort of what is, how do we understand this transformation and the emergent importance of the collectivity in the context of Arabic language discourse and its involvement perhaps with ideas of socialism in the context of the work this chapter is doing?
I mean, I think in some ways this also connects to something that we just discussed, which is really sort of the importance of Spencer in this story. And I think, you know, the question of kind of individualism and collectivism emerged in my mind, in any case, partly out of trying to think about how I would encounter such wildly different readings of Spencer, right? So that someone would be, you know, in the 1870s or 1880s, using Spencer to uphold a kind of staunch individualist ethos in which the state basically retracts from any responsibility for collective welfare, because of course that would impede the individual development and evolutionary progress that each person was meant to kind of struggle for on their own somehow, irrespective of the limits that the state and actual social and political context would impose upon them. But in any case, I think that that was one reading, you know, for instance, that many people early on, especially the Muqtadaf group coming out of the Syrian Protestant College and the kinds of stuff that they were reading, promoted early on. And then it slowly starts to shift and you'd get these other readings of Spencer and also of Darwin, in which a more kind of collectivist ethos was being promoted, and the idea of of individual struggle was really reinterpreted as a kind of collective struggle, and this is where a lot of anarchists and socialist ideas start to influence the way in which people were reading Darwin and reading evolutionary texts at that time. And so Kropotkin's ideas on mutual aid are really huge in Arabic, and many other thinkers, and in particular a lot of the Fabians, evolutionary utopians of that generation. So Wells and various other figures later on would also become quite important precisely for that connection. And, you know, this is a huge question. These are all huge questions, but this, you know, gets into the issue of thinking about collectivism and what we might call socialism in the 19th century and its pedigree, you know, both etymologically and politically in Arabic discourses. And so it picked up on that, and it's an important part of how I think Darwin is read, in fact. And, you know, one of the things I try and argue in that chapter is that really it's Darwin and not Marx that introduces socialism. And from our perspective, oftentimes that seems now like a kind of strange connection. But for many people in the 19th century around the world, again, I think that's how it was through evolution that you came to see the argument in favor of collectivism.
Thank you so much. And there are some discussions toward the end of this chapter, again, just to signal this for listeners who might be particularly interested in these topics. There are discussions of the founding of the first Egyptian Socialist Party, and the founder of that actually starts advocating a program for eugenics. So historians who are interested, or people interested in the history of eugenics, will find some particularly interesting material in this chapter. There's also a more extended idea of a theme we haven't talked that much about, but that recurs throughout many of the chapters, and this is the emergence of a Nahda, or Renaissance, in this context. And so that's also an important theme throughout this book. Now, as we come to the last body chapter before the afterword, though, we come back to Darwin. We come from Spencer to really focusing on what you call the first verbatim translation of Darwin's Origin of Species. Now, this first appears in Arabic in 1918, and in this first instantiation of the text, there are five chapters. It includes translations of chapters 1 through 5 of the 6th edition of The Origin of Species, and 10 years later, 1928, 4 chapters and some extra paratextual material are added to that translation. This is a fascinating case study here in the translation of scientific texts more generally, and one of the really interesting things happening here is that you talk about the kinds of decisions in terms of terminology and translation of context, of concepts, rather, that are made by the Egyptian writer who's actually in charge of translating this text. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you talk about some of the ways that this writer, Ismail Mazhar, is attempting to, as you call it, domesticate Darwin, and the ways that he's using some classic texts, some medieval texts, to justify his use of words here?
Okay. Yeah, so Mazhar is an interesting figure, I think, because he, in the course of his career, really is very much engaged with this question of translation and is involved in a number of translation bureaus and things like this. So he himself spends a lot of time thinking and writing about translation. So that made him interesting to me in a number of ways as well, because it was rare really to find people meditating on the process of translation as they were translating. Right? So he would often, in his prefaces, for instance, describe, you know, so in the 1928 preface, for instance, there's a long description there of people's reactions to the translation. Right? And so he's very struck by this fact that almost everyone, as far as he presents it, asks the question, or some variety of the question, why did you bother to translate this at all? You know, if someone wanted to read this, they would probably be able to read it in, you know, in English or in French, and why do we need it in Arabic? And he found this such a strange question that he needed to kind of meditate on it, meditate upon it, really, and sort of try and figure out why people were asking it, and why they didn't see, as he saw, the kind of inherent value of producing a work in translation as an original work in a linguistic sense. And so for him, and this is what he really writes about in his 1920 preface, it wasn't just that the experience of reading the text was the same, but that it would actually, through the translation, transform how someone would think in that sort of host language. So I think one of the things that I try and get at in that chapter is really just to try and imagine how Mazhar approached the question of finding conceptual equivalents across languages, and in particular for Arabic, which has a very interesting kind of history and specific set of grammatical rules for word construction and also for translation, in fact. So I wanted to really just try and sort of think through with him in a way how one might approach different possibilities for terms, including ones like evolution or struggle, or some of the other ones that that he spends time thinking about. So it's really, that chapter is really just following kind of Mazhar think through this problem of finding the right equivalent in a new language, and thinking through the process of reading and translating, really.
Great. Thank you so much. So just to kind of also mention for listeners, you talk here in this chapter about the importance for Mazhar of evolution in terms of the progress of the moral and ethical life of man. So for him, science had political goals and implications. And I mention this because this is a part of the book that's actually really, really important that threads through all of the chapters, but that we haven't really had much time to talk about. But I want to signal for listeners, and that is the importance of the larger social and political context within which these transformations in sort of conceptual, discursive, intellectual milieu are actually happening. And so at many points of the book, you're contextualizing these translation and sort of intellectual activities within, for example, the context of the French invasion of Tunis in 1881, the British occupation of Egypt starting in 1882, and here in this chapter, we see also the implications for the success of the Turkish Republic under Ataturk, for what's happening here and for how Mazhar and others are thinking about these larger issues of evolution, society, morality, and the imbrication of science with not just now spirituality and religion, but also politics and society. So there's an afterword to the book as well, and I'll again just signal this for listeners. You bring us into a court case in Egypt in the late 1990s over a book published by an Egyptian religious scholar and Cairo University professor, which becomes controversial and sort of looks at the relationship between science and religious exegesis in a new way, and in a way that's a little bit different from what we've seen prior to the book. And so the afterword not only brings together the narrative elements that we've talked about in that are emergent in previous chapters, but also kind of moves us ahead into the late 20th century to look at how some of these elements have transformed. So, Marwa, I've taken up a lot of your time, and there's a ton more material that we could talk about. And it's an extraordinarily rich book, and we've really, 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 really just scratched the surface here. Is there anything in particular about, you know, any of the chapters or about the kind of work that the book is doing in general that we haven't had a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers?
I'm sure there's always more to be said about everything. I would just say that, that beginnings and endings are always kind of ambiguous things. But you know, so finding the right beginning and ending this book was a little tricky, I think, in some ways. And in particular, the ending was, I thought, more random in some ways, but I tried to make an argument there about the shift that occurs beginning in the interwar period, but as precedence earlier, and then sort of think about those sort of how the narrative and discussion over evolution really changes. And this is, again, I think something that happens in many places across the world. And I guess the last thing I would just say is that, you know, I think there is something quite interesting about this period in the 1960s and 1970s, and not just for the story that I'm telling here, but I think generally in terms of thinking about how people understand evolution and how people encounter it and read it and the variety of readers that it produces. And there's something in particular about the rise of a variety of programs out of UNESCO and various other international bodies where the kind of human evolutionary story gets mobilized and becomes important, I think, politically in that sense. And then there are the rise of other kinds of global discourses that are anti-evolutionary in nature as well, and you know, that are sort of counter to these, and so you get this kind of interesting, I think, proliferation. And so I think, I guess, the last thing I would say is that in some ways I stop where the publications in Arabic on evolution really take off, and the huge number of pamphlets, and some of these are ephemera, not always very easy to locate, but one finds them every now and then, or hears of them every now and then. So there's, you know, a lot more to be said about where this story ends up, but I don't really go there.
So now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on the book. I think it's going to be a landmark study for many, many, many decades to come. What's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you, and what are you working on now?
So now I'm working on universal history, I guess. So I decided to scale down. But I think it's connected actually to the first project in a sense, in that it's, I guess, I'm trying to confront some of the historiographical issues that I felt I faced when I was writing this book, and sort of think through the genesis of that story in a way. And so really just trying to think through the appeal of science for a lot of people like my popular science editors, or like Darwin's translator Ismail Mazhar, in the 19th and 20th centuries, and think about its importance for our understanding of world history.
Well, best of luck on that project. I'll look forward to talking with you about that book too, whenever that's done. It's really been a pleasure, Marwa. Congratulations, and thank you again.
Thanks. That was fun. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.